Hello and welcome. You are listening to Patrick Boyle on Finance, a podcast exploring ideas from quantitative finance, examining events occurring in markets right now and financial history to see what lessons can be taken away, including interviews with some of the most interesting people in the world of finance. To learn more about the podcast, visit onfinance.org.
The UK's FTSE 100 index closed at an all-time high this Monday as expectations for UK interest rate cuts weakened the pound and boosted stock prices. As exciting as a new all-time high might sound, in dollar terms or adjusted for inflation, the FTSE has hardly budged in 25 years. A recent report from Goldman Sachs says that the UK has significantly underperformed other advanced economies since the 2016 Brexit referendum, with lower growth and higher inflation. Their analysis shows that the British economy is 5% smaller than it would have been had it remained in Europe. The IMF listed the UK in its Fiscal Monitor publication last week as one of four large economies that critically need to take policy action to address fundamental imbalances between spending and revenues. They project UK debt to hit 98% of GDP by the end of the decade, which would still leave the country below the US, Italy and France, but the IMF say that they're concerned about the direction of Britain's borrowing position. Since 2016, consumer prices in the UK have risen by 31%, compared with 27% in the United States and 24% in the Eurozone. The FTSE 100 index has in recent years solidly underperformed European and American stocks. So what has gone wrong in the UK, and can it all be pinned on Brexit? London is still ranked as the number two financial hub in the world, just behind New York. But there are growing concerns that Britain is losing its relevance in global finance. The London Stock Exchange, which can trace its history back more than 300 years, has seen its trading volume decline significantly in recent years, and a number of British companies have even started listing their shares on other markets. According to Bloomberg, companies raised just $1 billion on the LSE last year, the lowest amount of capital raised on the exchange since 2009. While some of this decline can be explained by a global reduction in the number of IPOs and an increase in funding from private equity over that period, the fact that the British-based chip designer Arm chose to list in New York last year, despite lobbying from three prime ministers, was a particular humiliation for the once world-leading financial centre. 2 years ago, Paris overtook London as the largest stock market in Europe, as the total market cap of London-listed equities fell more than 30% from its high in 2007. Over the same period, the market cap of US-listed stocks tripled. It would be easy to blame all of this on Brexit, but Britain's decline as a global financial centre began well before 2016. The best record of long-term stock market performance comes from Dimson, Marsh and Staunton at London Business School, who release new analysis every year using more than 100 years of global stock market data. Their most recent report, which is linked in the video description, shows the relative sizes of equity markets at the end of 1899 and how this has changed over the last 125 years. British stocks today are trading at close to a record discount to American stocks. While it's easy to blame Brexit for this discount, a number of other factors contribute to at least some of the UK's recent underperformance. Before digging into the reasons for this, let me tell you about this week's video sponsor, 8sleep. 8sleep's pod cover is redefining sleep. The pod cover improves your sleep by automatically adjusting your bed's temperature based on your individual needs. The cover can be added to any bed like a fitted sheet and allows you or your partner to cool or warm your side of the bed as low as 55 degrees and up to 110 degrees. I use an 8 sleep pod every night and I find this thing amazing. You're no longer stealing the blanket from your partner on cold nights and throwing it off on hot nights. It doesn't just warm or cool the bed, it has built-in sensors that track your sleep using the information to optimize your sleep. For example, some people need their temperature to drop while in deep sleep to maximize the length of that phase. The 8 Sleep Pod can adjust real-time the temperature of your side of the bed to your needs, and based on any changes in your environment, such as the temperature in your bedroom changing. It's remarkable how good my sleep is and how much the 8 Sleep Pod affects that. You can go to 8sleep.com/boil and use the code BOIL to get $200 off the pod plus free shipping. 8 Sleep currently ship to the US, Canada, UK, EU and Australia. The research from Dimson Marsh and Staunton at London Business School shows how the relative sizes of global equity markets have changed from 1899 to the present day. Their data shows that it's not just the UK market that's fallen in significance over the last 124 years. Today, the US market accounts for more than 60% of total world equity market value, with Japan in second place, the UK in third, and mainland China in fourth place. The US equity market overtook the UK in the early 20th century, and apart from a short period at the end of the 1980s when Japan briefly became the world's largest market, the US stock market has generally dominated. Towards the end of the 19th century, faster economic growth in the United States allowed it to first catch up and then overtake Britain in terms of GDP per capita. By the late 1920s, the gap had widened such that American real GDP per capita was 131% of that in the UK. While British growth slowed somewhat, American growth accelerated, driven by unprecedented productivity advances and a switch of technological leadership from Britain to the United States. In recent years, when compared to US stocks, British stocks just seem to move sideways, and this might be because British stocks are cheap or because American stocks are expensive, but there may be other explanations too. To take a simplistic approach, the FTSE is today trading at a price-to-earnings ratio of 14 compared to the S&P 500's PE of 23, meaning that you can buy a dollar of earnings in the UK at a roughly 40% discount to the price in the United States. But it's not necessarily reasonable to compare two markets that way, as the UK market is heavily weighted towards sectors like banks, natural resources and mining, and not the high-growth tech stocks that make up almost 30% of the S&P 500. As Robert Armstrong pointed out in a recent FT article, investors have been paying more and more for growth stocks rather than value stocks in recent years, which can be clearly seen in this chart showing the discount of the Russell Value Index to the Russell Growth Index, both of which are made up of American stocks. Additionally, investors have been willing to pay more and more for American stocks relative to stocks from the rest of the world, as can be seen in this chart. Finally, investors have been favoring large cap stocks in recent years, and this chart shows how large cap American stocks have outperformed mid cap American stocks by almost 5% a year over the last 5 years. Armstrong argues that the UK stock market is facing a triple hex at the moment, with smaller companies on average than in the US, which are more weighted towards value sectors than US indices are, and which are by definition outside the US. While these factors may explain a big chunk of the underperformance, they don't explain everything, as UK stocks are not only trading at a discount to US stocks, but they're also trading at a wide discount to European stocks. On top of this, while UK stocks have long traded at a discount to US stocks, the size of that discount began widening in 2016, and around that time, the discount to European equities first appeared. According to research from Schroders, when you adjust for industry weightings, almost every UK industry group trades at a valuation discount to the US equivalent. The idea that there would be a large, unexplained and persistent valuation gap between different listing locations doesn't make a ton of sense, especially in this day and age when investors can easily look around the world for investment opportunities. If such a discount did exist, value-driven investors who are more concerned with earnings than stock price momentum should look to invest in these cheaper, internationally listed stocks, especially when so many of the US investors I speak to voice concern about how expensive the US stock market is. If Brexit was to blame for this valuation gap, you'd expect to see a Brexit discount applied to the companies most exposed to the UK economy. When we look at the biggest stocks in the FTSE 100, you see companies like Shell, AstraZeneca, HSBC, Unilever and BP. These are companies that produce and sell their goods internationally. While they are UK listed, they're not solely focused on the UK market, and Brexit shouldn't affect these companies any more than it affects a large German or American multinational company. You wouldn't reasonably expect smart investors to overlook the international nature of these businesses and only care about where the companies are listed. You'd imagine that most investors don't really care where a company is listed as long as it's listed in a shareholder-friendly regulatory and legal regime. London's attractiveness as a listing venue, in particular for technology stocks, appears to have become tainted in 2021, when tech stocks like Deliveroo and Wise were listed on the LSE only to quickly see their share prices slump. VC firms argued that this happened because the institutional investors that dominate the London market don't understand tech and that they were looking for cash flows rather than growth, unlike American investors. Now, while this might be true, it's possibly worth asking to what extent a bicycle food delivery app is technology. It's been a couple of hundred years since the bicycle, which I still call the Swift Walker, was considered high tech. It's hard to know if these firms would have performed any better if listed on the NASDAQ rather than the LSE, especially when about 40% of the demand for European IPOs comes from US investors. Nonetheless, the poor performance of these stocks did make tech VCs wary of IPOing stocks in the UK. Now, the IPO price isn't the only thing that firms consider when choosing an exchange to list on, especially for companies like Arm, where SoftBank was only selling 9% of the shares to the public. Stock market liquidity, research coverage, and regulations will matter a lot too. With regard to liquidity, the UK, unlike the US and Germany, charges a 0.5% stamp duty for share purchases, a form of financial transaction tax. This tax reduces stock market liquidity as it encourages investors to trade less, making it cheaper to buy and sell securities abroad rather than in the UK. Oddly enough, the UK regulations exempt cryptocurrencies, ETFs, contracts for difference and spread betting from stamp duty, which possibly even drains liquidity from equities in favour of these products. A lot of small UK investors use spread betting platforms to invest rather than buying and selling stocks because doing so is more tax efficient. UK regulators have been moving to make Britain more competitive from a regulatory perspective, and the recent consultation paper from the FCA proposes new rules to reduce regulatory burdens relating to listing requirements and M&A. In the City of London, a well-worn explanation for the UK stock price discount is that due to regulations introduced 20 years ago, British pension funds have spent decades reducing their stock exposure in order to buy bonds. On top of this, British institutions have also been busy diversifying internationally over the same period, leaving less domestic capital available for investment into UK-listed stocks. The regulation in question was introduced in the early 2000s, when the British government brought in new rules requiring companies to hold pension deficits on their balance sheets. This triggered a big shift among UK pension funds out of the stock market and into bonds. In the early 1990s, UK pension funds owned about one-third of UK-listed companies. Today, they own 2% of UK-listed stocks, and now foreigners own 58%. Oliver Jones at Rathbones published some interesting research in January, trying to understand if British stocks are actually cheap, and if they are, what's causing the discount. Jones built a regression analysis that adjusted for the size, the profitability, and the sector composition of the UK market. He analysed a pool of more than 1,000 global stocks, 140 of them being UK listed. He found that the average UK stock's forward PE ratio is 16% lower than the average stock listed elsewhere in Europe and 32% lower than the average stock listed in the United States. He went on to compare valuations based on other characteristics such as sales growth, profitability, and interest coverage, finding that in each case, firms with higher scores for these characteristics have higher PEs, which is what you'd expect, as investors are willing to pay up for stocks with higher growth and higher quality. Jones found that even after accounting for these factors, the UK discount remains large at about 22%, meaning that firms in the same sector with identical growth and quality characteristics are cheaper if they're listed in the UK rather than in the US. The research found that the UK discount emerged after the 2016 Brexit referendum, as when the analysis was performed using older data, no statistically significant UK discount relative to the US was found. Jones found that the same discount appears to be applied to multinationals as to companies that earn all of their revenue in the UK, which he argues doesn't really make much sense. He dismisses the well-worn pension fund argument, pointing out that the timing of the appearance of this discount doesn't line up with the UK pension fund regulations, and he concludes that the most likely explanation for the UK's valuation discount is a general pessimism towards UK equities after the Brexit vote. He backs this argument up by highlighting a Bank of America survey of global fund managers, which shows a deterioration in sentiment towards UK stocks in the second half of the last decade, around the time of the Brexit vote. It's quite possible that global investors feel that the UK had a good deal within the EU and irrationally ended it, and that this reflects badly on how the country is being run in general. The constant turnover in political leadership since the Brexit referendum might have reinforced the feeling that the country is in disarray. So does the UK stock market's focus on old economy stocks when compared with American indices say something about the future expected return of British stocks? Well, the research from Dimson, Marsh and Staunton at London Business School shows that markets at the beginning of the 20th century were dominated by railroads, which were the tech stocks of their day. They point out that of the US firms listed in 1900, some 80% of their value was in industries that are small or extinct today. The figure for the UK is 65%. They go on to highlight the high proportion of today's companies that come from industries that were small or non-existent in 1900. The largest global businesses today and the largest sector globally in 2024 is technology. In prior research, Dimpson, Marsh and Staunton analysed whether investors should focus on new industries and avoid the old declining sectors. They found that new and old industries can both reward and disappoint investors equally. What matters most, they found, is whether stock prices correctly embed expectations. Essentially, any business can be a good investment if you invest at a good price. Their research shows that while railroads have been the ultimate declining industry over the period of their research, in the period since 1900, railroad stocks have actually beaten the US stock market and outperformed both trucking stocks and airlines since these newer industries emerged in the 1920s and 30s. They found that if anything, investors may have placed too high an initial value on new technologies, overvaluing the new and undervaluing the old. The takeaway being that valuation matters more than an ability to spot the new thing. Megan Green, an external member of the Bank of England's Monetary Policy Committee, pointed out in a recent FT article that expected growth in the UK is significantly lower than expected growth in the United States, and that potential growth is made up of two main components: potential productivity growth and labour supply. She points out that the UK looks worse than the United States on both fronts. So what is going on with British productivity then? A 2004 paper by Broadbury and Irwin shows that in 1850, Britain led the world in terms of productivity. American workers at the time produced roughly 10% less than British workers, but by 1910, America had taken the lead and US workers now produced 25% more. After two world wars and the loss of an empire, Britain's labour productivity was below that of not just America, but also France and Germany. In the global financial crisis, a productivity slowdown hit all countries, but Britain's productivity slowdown was particularly severe. Between 2009 and 2019, its productivity growth rate was the second slowest in the G7. Green points out in her FT article that investment is one way to boost productivity growth. In macroeconomics, investment means addition to a nation's capital stock of buildings, equipment, software, and inventories. So it doesn't mean buying stocks. It means investing money in the things that make workers more productive. Business investment in the UK was essentially flat between 2016, the year of the Brexit referendum, and 2020. And this lack of business investment does make intuitive sense over that period, as there was a huge increase in business uncertainty. A business owner isn't going to spend money on new manufacturing equipment or expand their office space when it's unclear what new trade regulations might be in the pipeline. This uncertainty about what's around the corner for Britain's firms due to Brexit is one explanation for low British investment, but it's not the only one. The lack of investment after the Brexit vote came in the wake of a period of very low investment for the UK. An Economist article from 2022 highlights that Britain has consistently invested less than France, Germany, and America, and that Britain also consistently spends less on research and development. US business investment growth, on the other hand, outstripped that of all other advanced economies in the period since 2016. The other factor that Green argued could have increased expected growth in the UK is labour supply. Green points out that the difference in labour supply between Britain and the United States is also stark. Labour market participation in the UK has not recovered to the pre-pandemic trend, while participation in the US has exceeded the pre-COVID trend. Figures from the OECD show that in terms of labour force participation, the UK is a significant outlier among its peers. All other G7 nations now have more people working or looking to work than before the pandemic, while more than a fifth of working age adults in the UK are deemed not to be actively looking for work. A total of 9.25 million people of working age are now classed as economically inactive, up from 8.55 million in February 2020. According to The Telegraph, there's been a jump in those claiming benefits where they are not required to look for work, such as for long-term sickness. The Guardian argues that this is due to underinvestment in health and social care, and the BBC says that people in their 20s are not working due to poor mental health. The ONS has warned that their data may not be accurate, as the survey upon which these results are based had a smaller number of respondents than has historically been the case. In many ways, filling out a survey is a type of work, and if you're not interested in working, you might not be interested in filling out surveys about it either. The Economist article about Britain's low levels of investment and R&D argues that adjustments for the capital available to workers explains almost all of the gap between GDP per hour worked in Britain and France, and explains about a third of the gap between Britain and Germany. The Economist argues that while Britain has been successful in encouraging young people to go to university, the nation has struggled to equip workers with the specific skills that employers demand. They highlight that while Britain has world-beating research universities, it struggles to spread the knowledge developed at those universities to companies. Compared with America, for example, the UK relies relatively heavily on universities and less so on national labs, which tend to be more focused on applied research. On average, Britons take out patents at about half the rate that American, French and German citizens do. The research seems to show that British stocks are indeed cheap relative to US stocks, and that some of the discount is down to pessimism around Brexit, and that some of the pessimism may even be unfounded. But a number of other multi-decade trends, such as investors favouring mega-cap tech stocks, investors focusing on growth rather than on value stocks, and investors paying a premium for American stocks versus international stocks, are also in the mix. There's no obvious catalyst that will help you time when investors change their minds, or if they change their minds, causing these multi-decade trends to reverse direction. UK business activity rose more than expected in April, and a recent uptick in M&A activity in UK stocks, where deals with multiple offers and high premiums have been announced, and this could possibly signal that investors are starting to recognise the value in British stocks. Britain is now in its 16th year of anemic productivity growth, and while many of the drivers behind the productivity slowdown were global, about half of the slowdown in the UK can be attributed to a failure to invest in capital and skills. Thanks for joining this week's podcast. Don't forget to check out our sponsor, 8Sleep, using the link in the podcast notes to get $200 off the price of an 8Sleep pod, along with free shipping. Have a great day and talk to you again next week. Bye.
If you enjoyed this episode, be sure to subscribe so you're notified when a new episode is posted. Thank you to everyone who is supporting this content on Patreon. If you enjoyed this content, you can find more like it on YouTube, on the Patrick Boyle on Finance channel, or follow us on Twitter @Patrick E. Boyle. Thanks for listening. Bye.